WGN, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Michael Miller is an economist at DePaul University, a regular guest on this show, especially when stuff gets complicated. Hello, Mr. Miller. How are you today?
I'm doing well, King John. It's a great day, huh?
Well, I suppose it could be, depending on what you choose to look at. In fact, that's interesting because as bad as we make it sound on the radio, maybe because it's bad, you see mixed signs in the economic picture, don't you?
I really do. I look at the macroeconomic data that we focus upon when we're trying to decide when the economy is going to change from growing to receding. In other words, what would happen at a peak in the business cycle when things turn bad? And generally, you would see some kind of turnaround in sales, employment, income, gross domestic product, industrial production, all these different manufacturing. And every single one of those indicators are doing fine. And so, you know, we know for sure we don't have a recession now, and it would take one heck of a turnaround, say, in the next couple of months for it to start soon. But there are signs that are telling us that the future is not looking quite so bright. You know, for example, housing, many of us are wealthier because our home prices have gone up 20% in just the past year. But looking forward, the housing market has begun to stall. And we see that permits are down, and housing, given the interest rates on mortgages, housing is going to slow down. Of course, the stock market is almost always a sign that there's a recession on the horizon. And I just looked at some data before I came on, and S&P has entered bear territory. We're down more than 20%. And so a lot of wealth has been destroyed, and household wealth from that perspective has gone down. And, of course, we have inflation, which has weighed heavily on confidence. So households are employed. They're getting raises, not big enough to offset inflation. Their houses are going up, but their confidence is very weak going forward because they're worried about things like the stock market and so forth. So it's really a mixed bag. But, you know, if you look at it purely by the macro indicators that say recession versus growth, everything currently is pointing to growth.
To growth. And I'm sorry, so that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
But I wanted to run this by you, if I may. Mike Miller, he's an economist at DePaul University. Is the reason that we have the inflation because we have too many dollars in the market? And do we have too many dollars in the market because of the stimulus? And do all of our problems right now stem from all of those government giveaways of the last 2 years?
Wow. You know, that is an excellent question. So what I do is I always return to what I would say, what does the economic theory tell us? And theory tells us that inflation can be caused by three things. The cost of doing business is going up, and that will be passed on to the consumers. The demand is outstripping the supply, that so many people are out there wanting to buy that they will bid up the prices so that they can get their hands on it. And lastly, if there's some major spike in the money supply, that means that the value of the pieces of paper we use to exchange become less and less valuable. And in this particular case, it seems to me that all three of them exist. Hmm. We do have a supply chain problem, which has to be passed on. We do have rising wages to get people to go to work, and that has to be passed on. So that has nothing to do with the stimulus program. However, the stimulus program certainly did dramatically increase demand. When they gave us money, you and I spent that money, and the government itself spent a lot of money. But, you know, that doesn't always turn into inflation when the government runs those kinds of deficits. Ultimately, the level of inflation will be controlled not by the federal government, but by the Federal Reserve. And what happened was...
Hold on one second, Mike. I'm going to ask you to pick it up right there because that's a question I think a lot of us have. Who are these people? It sounds like we're looking for someone to blame. Maybe we are. Maybe it's not you or me or the Congress, but if the Federal Reserve did not act quickly enough on interest rates, then okay, this is their fault. I want you to pick it up there in just a minute. Michael Miller is a professor of economics at DePaul. We talk to him when we've got questions about the economy, which is all the time. So you just brought up the Fed, Michael, and it seems to me like they've just got one kind of tool in their box, and it's this thing where they adjust the interest rates. Did they make a mistake? Should they have been more aggressive sooner? Are they to blame for the inflation right now?
You know, I believe that the Fed is feeling that as way I think many people are. James Bullard, who is the president of the St. Louis Fed, in fact, just wrote an article that he made public about, did we wait too long? So the fact that he even has to ask the question makes it clear that they probably did. And they do have two arrows in their quiver. One is that they change interest rates, but the other one is that they also provide liquidity. The Federal Reserve has the power to buy off of the open market government securities. And by doing that, it makes it easier for the government to run deficits. And see, ultimately, you asked that question. Did Mr. Biden's policies and Mr. Trump before it, did that cause the inflation? And a lot of people say, well, of course, it dramatically raised demand and outstripped supply, and that causes price to rise. However, we do know that the Federal Reserve bought up a very large proportion of that new debt, and that is something they did not have to do. They could have simply allowed the interest rate to rise. What the Fed essentially did is they printed money to allow the government to run those deficits. And so ultimately, I think 5 to 10 years from now, when the history of this inflation is written, I think most of the blame will sit upon the Fed for buying all of that, all of those bonds off of the market, pumping up the money supply. It did make it easier for the government to do that spending, but ultimately it's the Fed. The Fed is the one who has the tools necessary to control inflation. It is not Mr. Biden. It is not Congress.
Okay, but when we hear the Fed did this, the Fed did that, we always hear about the Fed chairman, but there are these mm-hmm. other governors. So is it a majority vote, or does this one guy make the decision?
No, it is a majority vote. What you have are the seven people appointed by the president for very long terms. They're ratified by the Senate. That's the Board of Governors. And then the 12 presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and they all get together 8 times a year to discuss the economy, and they come up with a decision, a policy decision. And when it finally comes time to vote on it, the seven governors vote and 5 of the 12 presidents vote, and then it's a majority. But it's almost always a unanimous or within 2 votes. There sometimes are differences. But it does make clear that the seven people the president appoints, And those presidents kind of represent their different constituencies. You know, some of the Federal Reserve banks have lots of agrarian workers, some have commercial, some have their trade and farming and so forth. And so there'll be different opinions among the 12 presidents. But in general, the 12 presidents are highly suspect of inflation. And that's what makes this whole episode so strange, is that the Fed does seem that the presidents of the banks voted in favor of these purchases of huge mm-hmm. amounts of government securities, which printed money, which ultimately led to the inflation. So I think it could be that the Fed was asleep at the switch and they moved too late.
You said that they have different constituencies, but they're also appointed by the president with the approval of the Senate. So maybe it is, though, a reflection of the administration that way, or is it not?
It is. Certainly the chair, which is Jerome Powell, because even though the other 6 members have 14-year terms, very long terms, the chair has only a 4-year term. So under the way the Fed has been constructed, every president gets the chance to appoint the chair of the Federal Reserve. So Mr. Trump did not like Janet Yellen, whom I actually kind of thought was a very good chair. He replaced her with Jerome Powell. And then when Mr. Biden became president, he had the chance. And it was very touch and go. It was not clear that Jay Powell was going to get the job. But he did, and Congress said fine, and I mean everything went through, and so now he has a 4-year term, and he can't be fired now that he's been appointed, except for cause. Jerome Powell will be in charge of the Federal Reserve, and it will be he'll be the voice and the face of the Fed, and it's part of his job is to whip everybody else into a consensus that they can sell to the public and do so with confidence. One thing the Fed wants to have is credibility, and that they make decisions with confidence. And that's Jay Powell's job, is to make sure that that's what this committee called the Open Market Committee does.
Mike Miller, your job is to help us understand these things, and you did your job again today, so thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. You Michael, got it. It was my pleasure.
Michael Miller is an economist at DePaul University. Wintrust Business Lunch, a little sunshine peeking through downtown. Maybe there is some sunshine on our horizon. Rebecca Ryan joins us again, the futurist on WGN Radio on the Wintrust Business Lunch, who just spoke at a global panel on Tuesday. Gave a speech in Texas yesterday talking about the reasons for businesses to be optimistic about the future. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back.
Hey, John. And may I say happy 100th birthday to everybody in the WGN Radio family.
Yeah, that's nice of you to say. It's been a good run, and we hope to keep it going.
Well, it's, you know, there are a lot of organizations celebrating big birthdays. The American Heart Association is turning 100 very soon, too. And when I think about that, it's like, okay, so that's five generations ago. Those folks had foresight, didn't they? They were futurists.
Yeah. Well, you are. When you spoke at these two conferences just recently, we just had an economist on who said, you know, there's a lot of good things happening, and yet inflation and interest are sort of driving the bus. What are you seeing and what are you saying about the future?
Yeah, I mean, inflation and interest rates are driving the headlines, and they are having an impact. But what I think is driving the bus is innovation. You know, COVID gave us this intense acceleration of trends that we had already known about. You know, we knew that some people could work from home, but boom, now, you know, more people are working from home. And we knew that we needed to probably automate some parts of our, you know, supply chain or distribution chain, but boom, now we're really trying to do that. So I'm really bullish on what's happening now. The number of people applying for their business licenses is going up. So I think we're going to have a lot more oxygen in the economy because of this acceleration.
More business licenses. What's that all about?
Yeah, so employer identification numbers, the applications for those are just soaring. And I think it's two things. One, it's people who say, I'm not going to go to work in the same way I used to, so I'm going to become a freelancer. And then there are other people who are saying, hey, now's the time. You know, I left my job. I really want to do something new. I've always wanted to start this business. Now's the time. So I think it's a series of things.
Not necessarily all bad things. I mean, the economy will be what it will be. The marketplace will be what it will be. But if it's sort of turning in that direction, I don't know that we pass judgment on that, do we?
No, I certainly don't. I mean, we call it a free market, right? The idea is that there should be freedom for people to leave their jobs, for companies to increase wages, for new entrepreneurs to come into the business, into different sectors. And, you know, as a free market economist myself, when there are new startups who are competitive, it creates a little more pressure on the existing businesses often to kind of raise their game. And then what ends up happening for the consumer or for the buyer is that they get a better experience. So I think net-net, it's a plus for consumers. Yes, there is some fallout from businesses that can't make it, or their fundamentals are bad, or they just had some really bad luck. But that is part of being in a free market economy.
Rebecca Ryan is an economist and futurist. You also said something about first principles. What are those, and how are those in play?
Yeah, so first principles are like the very basic things that we've got to find answers for if we want to run a successful business. So I'm an entrepreneur myself. You know, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch, so you've got a lot of business listeners, entrepreneurs, small business owners, people who are managers and leaders. And so in terms of the first principles that I think we should be asking ourselves to navigate the future, the first one is, why do we really exist? Like, what is the real value that you're providing to clients? So an example would be, like, nursing homes would say, oh, we have to take care of our nursing home patients. My mom happens to be in a nursing home, right? And there's a lot of rules and regulations around how my mom has to be taken care of. But if nursing homes really think about who they're serving, they're also serving the loved ones of their patients. So you're seeing very proactive nursing homes saying, we're going to increase, we're going to create a new position for the family liaison, or we're going to start having regular care meetings with all of the families of our patients so that we increase the care for, not just for our patients, but for the loved ones of our patients. So that's an example of asking and answering that first principle.
Yeah. Go ahead and finish that thought.
Yeah. It just, you know, I think sometimes if things are stable for a long, long time, we can delude ourselves a little bit. So a great example is everyone's been talking about, like, return to office. Are we going to return to office? Are we not going to return to office? Are we going to be a hybrid model? And I think the delusion sometimes is that we have confused the office for work. And the office may have been a place where teams met, but if you really think about the business that you're in and the value you provide, the office is not the value, right? So this is a first principle question.
What do we do? Who's our client? Who are we serving? So, right, the office should serve the people. The people don't necessarily need to serve the office. Office occupancy rates in Chicago are still below 50%. I don't know that they'll get to 100% of 2019, but I think a lot of us also do see the value in the collection of people in the same place physically. You don't necessarily?
No, I do, but I want to have a nuanced view of this, right? So there are certain times and certain moments where that physically being together really, really matters. So Salesforce is a company in California, and what they have said is, listen, we know that when we onboard new employees, we must be together. So they've leased 1440 Multiversity, which is this beautiful campus, and they've said, we're going to have all of our new employee onboarding on this beautiful campus. It's going to be all together. It's going to be a really unique environment because we want those new employees to have an amazing experience. So what I'm seeing is that the most foresighted companies are really thinking carefully about how they use the office or how they use space when they bring people together and when they don't.
You know, you've also got me thinking about something you said a moment ago, and that is, you know, who are your customers? What are we in the business of doing? And in the case of, a senior citizen facility, what about the families and how are we accommodating them? Because it's one person in the facility, but maybe 10 people that are directly affected by that. My mom is in a rehabilitation facility herself right now. She recently fell and broke her hip, and so she's in a rehab center where she's living. And I think the accommodations for her and the attention to her and the family are terrible, and it's a nice place. A lot of that I blame on staffing. The people there are wonderful. There are not enough of them. And so where some simple accommodations, like how is my mom going to answer the phone when she's hooked up to various wires and she's not very mobile and the phone is ringing on a table behind her head over by a lamp that she can't reach? That little thing, that little stupid thing, I think, why don't you people appreciate the fact that she can't talk to anybody now because the phone's behind her head? And you know what? I don't know that they know that that's an issue. I hope they care. But I do know this. They don't have enough people to pay attention to that. They're understaffed.
Right. And this is, yes, I mean, when you are understaffed, it's hard to even cover first principles, right? But in that situation, how do we think about, all right, well, your mom can't reach her phone. Her phone is behind her. And if we need to assist your mom, maybe we say, like, hey, you know, we're going to be in your mom's room between 5 and 5:30 p.m. If you guys want to talk to her, somebody will be there to help her to make sure that she can have access, that you can talk with her. I mean, I think about what the nurses did during COVID, right, of getting those FaceTime calls with families.
Yeah,
those nurses were doubling as kind of the communication liaisons to family, in addition to running IVs and doing all these things.
Yeah, I have, you know, so you can tell I'm a little angry about this. I hope it also sounds like I have sympathy to everybody involved, because I do think it's a staffing issue. But you're right. Then if this is the hand we've been dealt, then maybe even we as adult children or the patients, the clients, if you will, we all start to need to start thinking out of the box, like what are solutions under these situations right now? That's maybe not a first principle thing. Maybe it is, but I think we all need to start getting smarter about this.
Well, you know, I would think that a first principle in your mom's case is returning her to health and wholeness and not feeling isolated and staying connected with you guys. That is going to be an important part of her healing process as well. So I think in some ways, I honestly, I've worked in business now for over 25 years. One of the things I don't think we do well is I don't think we engage all of the staff in thinking through solutions. You know, we tend to think that the CEO or the director of nursing is going to figure it out. Well,
yeah.
You know, that's not fair or realistic either. But if we engage everybody who's caring for your mom in thinking about what a solution would be, boom, we would probably have something that would be better than any of us could come up with.
Hey, Rebecca, you hit a nerve. Can you tell?
I love it, man. And I'm really sorry about your mom.
No, that's okay. And she's not the only person in that facility. But I think you're on to something here. Rebecca Ryan is an economist and futurist. Why don't you check her stuff out at RebeccaRyan.com. And we'll call you another day, Rebecca. Thanks for your help.
Thanks, John.
It's 12:46. I'm really ticked about that, by the way. And that's not the only thing that's bugging me. But let's move on to the WGN Radio Newsroom. More business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A newly released report from the U.S. Census Bureau shows Illinois is among six states that were undercounted in the 2020 census. It's a nearly 2% undercount and means the state's population grew by nearly 250,000 people. The state's population is now above 13 million for the first time in history. Governor Pritzker says the numbers show that Illinois is on the rise, and he'll be working with state lawmakers to ensure that Illinois receives its fair share of federal funding. There is concern over Mayor Lightfoot's plan to create an outdoor entertainment venue with a liquor license at the site of the former Morton Salt plant on North Alston Avenue. The City Council's License Committee advanced the mayor's plan over strong objections from neighboring Alderman Brendan Riley and Michelle Smith, along with Friends of the Chicago River. The aldermen say it's too close to residential areas. Friends of the Chicago River says the area should be a place of peace and a contrast to the urban environment. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And the business of food, the Steve Alexander.
Yeah, nothing says business of food more than the National Restaurant Show, which kicks off tomorrow at McCormick Place, a four-day run. It's kind of a palooza for thousands of people in the restaurant, food service, hospitality industries. New products, new equipment, lots of experts offering advice. That all starts tomorrow. But today is Mr. Fizz Friday. And Jim, some listeners have questions, including we're new to gardening and we're just now ready to start. How do we begin and are we too late?
Well, it's not too late. But the first thing you need to do...
Hold on. I got to change something there. Give me a second, John, and I'll figure this out.
Well, that's all right. You want me to talk about restaurants and my experiences?
You can continue venting about your mom if you'd like.
You know, even as I started that, I'll get out of your way here, but I'll finish this sentence. I thought there is a conversation to be had here for those of us who are watching the hospital or senior care for our loved ones. What are you seeing? And that's a show for another day, Steve.
Oh, that's a big show, I'll tell you. Anyway, here's Mr. Fizz.
Well, it's not too late. But the first thing you need to do when you're getting started is a little planning. You need to figure out what the location will be. It has to be convenient near the house. It has to be near water. Should have full sun if possible and decent soil with good drainage. And I like to start with something like a 10 by 10 garden. That's 100 square feet, and you can grow quite a bit of stuff in those gardens. And then you need to plan on what to grow. Grow something your family will eat. No sense in growing rutabagas if you're the only one in the family that will eat them. The other thing you need to think about is what's the best to grow for the time and effort you're going to put in. And there's a list of those things. It starts with tomatoes, especially caged tomatoes, then pole beans, bush squash, peppers, and so forth. Things that don't take a lot of space, come out quickly, and produce very well. It's a little late to start some things from seed, but you can buy transplants. There's still plenty of them around, the tomatoes and the peppers and some of the herbs and so forth. Just set them in the soil, firm them in, water them in. There is time for some things to be seeded, beans and beets. And the vine crops like squash and cucumbers, and if you're going to grow a watermelon, that too, and they come up pretty quickly. that's about it.
Mr. Fizz, gardening guru Jim Fizzell, who also points out that there are a lot of books available for beginning gardeners, including some written by him. And since we've been celebrating WGN history this week, Jim began doing gardening reports with Orion in 1961, just a year after the Big O started here. And for most of the years since, he has been a regular contributor, Mr. Fizz. From the farm to your belly, today is National Pick Strawberries Day. Tomorrow's National Strawberries and Cream Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We've got just enough time to tell you about a good walking tour or seven in Chicago. Here's Will Quam. He's the founder of Brick of Chicago. Will, do you only walk on brick-lined streets, or do you do paved streets and sidewalks too?
Hey there. We walk on sidewalks. We walk on streets. Sometimes we might jaywalk a little bit. But we certainly walk on plenty of brick-paved streets as well.
And is this a sort of neighborhood tour in Chicago? Where do you go?
Yeah, so I offer a bunch of different tours. So right now I'm in Logan Square, Old Town, Bronzeville, Hyde Park, and Fulton Market and Rogers Park as well. So these are tours developed to look at neighborhoods, sort of looking at neighborhoods across Chicago as the sum of their parts. It starts with the brick. You know, Chicago is this incredible brick city. But then it's all about this vernacular architecture, learning how to read the buildings in your neighborhood, and then hearing some of the crazy stories that might have happened to them throughout history.
Now, are you new to this game? I know of some walking tours. How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing the tours for about 4 years now, and it's a lot of fun. I'm the one who leads every tour, and I'm the one who develops and researches them all as well. So it's a great time.
What's the most popular neighborhood? Where do folks want to go?
Old Town, I've just premiered this year, and that's been a really popular one. It's very fun. You know, you get to see a lot of these buildings built right after the fire, these little cottages in these ornate styles. But then you get a lot of really cool mid-century buildings as well, as a lot of young architects move to the neighborhood and really change the architecture game, building these small houses in the midst of these historic buildings. So that's a really fun one to really see the scope of how the city changed throughout the years.
I got to wrap it up now. How long are the walking tours? Are we out for an hour or two? How long do we go?
You'll be out for about an hour and a half. They each one goes about 1.5 miles. They're really a really great time, especially to explore new neighborhoods around the city and to maybe see your own neighborhood in a new way. You can check those out at brickofchicago.com.
Yeah, we'll call again, Will. That sounds like a great idea. We've been waiting so long to take a walk through the city, so let's do it now that the weather is turning. Brickofchicago.com. Will, good luck to you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, and congrats on 100 years.